Good morning, everybody.
It's really good to be back at Willoughby, and I think some of you might remember that I have come before and I spoke on the first question of the Heidelberg Catechism about Jesus being our only comfort. And ever since then, I've been wanting to come back sooner, but it's been taking a while because, like it was mentioned, Jesse and I had just had our first child, and her name is Kyla Emery Wu. And so Kyla comes from the Hebrew, which means who is like God. And it also has Hawaiian roots, which means ocean or style. So hopefully our little daughter will have some style, but also acknowledge that who is like God. And her middle name, Emery, means a refiner. And she is already refining us as we speak. Little children are like sanctification machines. I really believe that. And they kind of bring out the worst in you. And then, you know, it allows Jesus to come and kind of work on that. And so as, you know, my wife and I have been kind of just like drinking in this new life that's in our family, as I'm holding my little daughter in my hands, and as I'm thinking about what a great gift that this child has been from God, and what a great responsibility that we've been given to raise her, I've just been completely taken to a point where I just desire to teach her so much that, like it says in the answer, that's what we're going to talk about today. The first time I came, I talked about the first question of the Heidelberg. Today I want to talk about the answer of the first question of the Heidelberg. And what I want to teach, what I'm just drawn to teach this young one, is that that she belongs to Jesus, that her greatest joy comes when she realizes that she was put on this planet to love and serve the Lord. And so what I want to do today is I want to share a little bit about that foundation of joy that comes from knowing that we belong to Jesus, that we are put on this planet to love and serve the Lord. And to do that, what I want to do is I want to look at this parable, one of the latest parables, probably the latest parable that Jesus teaches. And that's in Mark chapter 12, verses 1 to 12. And so if you have your Bibles with you, pull them out. I'm going to be like camping in this passage for the remainder of the time that I have with you. And if you need to swipe or click or touch or flip, whatever you need to do to get to the passage, let's get there. And Mark chapter 12, verses 1, it reads like this. That's Jesus. He then began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the winepress, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. He sent still another, and that one they killed. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent them last of all, saying, "They will respect my son." But the tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and then the inheritance will be ours." So they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Haven't you read this scripture? The stone that the builders rejected has become the capstone. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Then they looked for a way to arrest him, because they knew he had spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away. So Jesus, here we see that Jesus is speaking a parable against someone. And who Jesus is speaking against are the chief priests, the teachers of the law of the temple, and the elders. And we learn this from the previous chapter of Mark. You know, Jesus basically here is speaking against the religious establishment. He's speaking against how they are using and how they are controlling the temple system for their own gain. But what the story that Jesus is telling here is much more than an allegory. And what I mean by that is the story that Jesus is telling here is much deeper than an indirect way of condemning the religious establishment. You see, the story that Jesus is telling here is also a parable. and parables will always reveal something about what the kingdom of heaven is like. They will always do this. And so we will see today how this parable tells us a little bit about the kingdom of heaven by looking at three different parts of the story. First, we're going to take a look at what it means to be owners and lords. Then we're going to take a look at what it means to be a servant and a steward. And finally, we're going to take a look at the true owner and the son. So first, we're going to take a look at what it means to be owners and lords. And so when I look at this parable, the first thing that I see, the thing that I think drives this story forward continually are the tenants in this vineyard. And the problem that we have in this parable is that these tenants that are hired to be servants and stewards, they do not want to be servants and stewards, right? They want to be owners and lords. They want to be in charge. They want the vineyard for themselves. And so they try all these reckless things to try and keep the property for themselves. And all of these things turn out to be ultimately futile. And you know, we should not let the implication of this passage escape us. Timothy Keller, a pastor from Redeemer Presbyterian, he says that there's a part in each of us that wants to be owner and lord of our own lives. There's parts in each of us that resonates with William Henley's poem Invictus when he says, "I am the master of my own fate. I am the captain of my soul." He is saying, "I want to be in charge. I want to live life the way I want to live." And you know, there are two general ways that we do this. We can try and be masters of our fate through religion, and that's what Jesus is accusing the authorities here of doing. Or we can try and be owner and lord of our lives through irreligion. We can try and deny God altogether so that we can live life how we want to live. And what I want to propose to you today is that both these ways of trying to be in charge, both these ways of trying to be owners and lords are just as reckless as what these tenants are doing in this parable. You know, when we try to be owner and lord of our lives through religion, when we try and control God through religion, what we can be doing is we can be subconsciously trying to treat God like some kind of universal vending machine. You know, we can begin to think that we can manipulate God to try and get what we want. We just need to figure out the right place to put the offering or the right moral act to do or the right prayer to pray to get the kind of job that we want, or the kind of satisfaction that we want, or the kind of peace that we want. But to think that God owes us anything is kind of reckless, isn't it? I mean, trying to control the God of the universe, I think, is like trying to sail on a tsunami. Like, it's probably not going to work out the way you want it to work out. You know, one of the ways that you can tell that this is happening, one of the ways that you can tell that you're trying to control God is that when God does not give you what you want, or when God does not give you what you expect, you get angry. You know, I remember, this is the exact emotion I felt when my mother got cancer when I was younger. I just remember just feeling anger, overwhelming anger, more than my need to pray, more than my need to trust Jesus, more than my need to do anything. There was just anger and frustration. Why? Because it felt like the vending machine wasn't working. It felt like, you know, it was broken. So I began shaking at God. I began pounding at him like he ate my quarters or something. And I began singing, "God, I did my prayers. You know, I am a good person. I did everything that I'm supposed to do. And so now you owe me. You need to give me what I want. You need to do this for me. You need to help my mother." You know, sometimes we can live the lives that we live because we love God and because we want to serve him. But sometimes we can live the lives that we live because we want to control God. And when we do that, we can begin to see God as a tool or a thing to be used to get the life that we want. So one way that we try to be owner and lord of our lives is through religion, and that can be kind of reckless. But the other way that we can do this is through irreligion, and I think that that can be just as reckless. And let me tell you why. You know, the atheist philosopher Albert Camus, if he was in Canada and there was no French accent, it would be Albert Camus. But he sounds much cooler because he's from France, so Albert Camus. And this atheist philosopher, he thought that when we deny God, we actually also end up denying that we have any real purpose on this planet. And that's because if we were created by God, we were given a purpose. We were given a reason for being. We were created to be servants and stewards of his vineyard. We were created to love and serve the Lord. But Camus says, when we deny God, we are also denying that our lives have been given any real meaningful purpose. You know, we just exist. And then we die. And anything that we do in between is inconsequential. Yes, we can have goals, we can have dreams, but it's not like they matter to the cold, godless universe. And what that means is, when you try to take control of your own life by denying God, you have to find a way to give your own life purpose, even though without God, Camus knew that there's no purpose to your life beyond itself. And the problem with that is that it's very difficult to live your life in that way. It's very difficult to live your life like there was no real reason for its existence. And that's why for Camus, the greatest philosophical question for him was, if there is no God, why don't we all commit suicide right now? That was the question that he struggled with the most through his philosophical career. And so you see, we can use both religion and irreligion to try and take charge of our lives. But both can be reckless. Both can lead to problems. When we try to be lords and owners of our own lives, we can find that wearing that crown can be harder than we think. So, the first thing is about this parable that we have to know is about owners and lords. We want to be owners and lords, but we were created to be servants and stewards. We were created to love and serve the Lord. It's like God created this planet like an owner plants and grows a vineyard, and it's given to us as a gift. And now we live to tend the vineyard. We live to care for the places that God has put us for his glory. That is what being a servant and a steward means. But there's this very strange thing that happens in our parable, isn't there? You know, the more the tenants are reminded of their role, the more the tenants are reminded that they are servants and stewards, the more upset they get. The first messenger that comes to remind them of their role, the first messenger is seized and beaten. And then the second messenger is struck on the head and treated shamefully. And then the third messenger is killed. And eventually it gets to this point where the owner's own son is killed. It's almost like that there is this gravity. It is almost like there is this draw to wanting to be owner and Lord. And so, church, you know, even when we want to be servants and stewards, I think that there is still an attraction in us that wants to be owners and lords of our lives. You know, there is part of us that still wants to reject God from being the true Lord of our lives. And so accepting Jesus as Lord is something that we need to continually work at. And I think that's why there's such a huge part of the Christian life that is what Paul calls dying to the self. What Paul calls this constant letting go of the desire to be in control. This constant letting go of the desire to live life the way we want to live it. And I think we can learn a lot about what this means by Jesus' last words in this parable. When he says, the stone that the builders rejected has become the capstone, or the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Did you know that in ancient architecture, the cornerstone, or the capstone, was the most important part of the building? It was the piece that kept the entire building together. Everything was built around the cornerstone. It was the weight that the entire building rested on. And so I think part of what Jesus is saying in this parable is that he is the Son that the religious leaders are going to reject and kill, but somehow he will then become the cornerstone. He will become the thing that holds everything together. And I think the other thing that our parable is pointing to here, though, is that part of what it means to be a servant and a steward of the Lord means to continually make Jesus our cornerstone. It means to continually build our lives around him, constantly make him the center of it all. And you know, I believe that when we do that, what we will find is that Jesus is able to take the weight of our life, that Jesus is able to hold it all together. You know, we can build our lives on all sorts of things. We can build our lives around our spouses, around our careers, around a cause. We can build our lives around ourselves. We can try to make all sorts of things our cornerstone, but they will never be able to take the weight of our hopes. They will never be able to take the weight of our expectations like Jesus can. You know, I am actually a part of this entire generation of immigrant children where parents had left everything they knew. They just picked up and left everything, and they came to Canada in order to give us a better life. And so for many immigrant parents that came over during this time, we became their cornerstone. We became the thing that they built their lives around. We became the thing that gave them purpose and gave them meaning. And you know, when you make someone your purpose, when you make someone the purpose for your existence, that is a lot of weight that you're putting on them. You know what I mean? And so growing up, you know, I have seen this weight crush so many of my friends. Many of us felt the pressure to not only do well in school, but to justify our parents' lives. And I am not exaggerating, because we knew that we were their cornerstone. We saw their joy and we saw their sadness go up and down with us. You know, we were kids. We were more volatile than the Dow Jones, but it was like they bet everything on us. Like they just, all their hopes, all their dreams, everything. And so don't get me wrong. I am so grateful for what my parents did for me, the opportunities that they have afforded me, all of those things. But what I'm trying to say to you today is that when you make anything but Jesus your cornerstone, whether it's a job or a relationship or yourself, either you are going to crush whatever it is you are putting the weight of your life on, or you are going to be disappointed and disillusioned. You know, wives, I'm just going to speak some truth here. Wives, if you make your husband your cornerstone, you will become disappointed and disillusioned. Most of us men need to be reminded to put up the toilet seat when we go to the bathroom. There is no way we should be expected to hold up your lives. That is just not how it should go. It is just a matter of time before we let you down. And you know, that's why I think that when you start looking at anything else to be your cornerstone, suddenly life starts looking like it's just fragile. Life starts looking like it can break at any moment. You're going to begin to hover around your children. You're going to check your bank account constantly. You're going to find yourself worrying about when you're alone at night, when you're all by yourself. Because deep down, you know all of these things, they cannot take the weight that you are putting on them. But you know, part of the joy of being a servant and steward to the Lord, part of that is continually making Jesus your cornerstone. It's continually growing in confidence, making Jesus the center of it all, and putting the full weight of your lives on him. So your jobs, your relationship, your money, like you just try and honor God first, and you trust that God will take care of the rest. And I'll tell you why that's a joy. It's a joy because it doesn't mean that there won't be difficulty. There will be difficulty. There will be times when you're disappointed. But it's a joy because when those difficult times come, when those challenges come, it means that there will be a cornerstone that you can lean on, that you can put the whole weight of your life on, that you can trust on, and that cornerstone is not going anywhere. It is not going to crumble. It is not going to crack. It is going to be right there. And I think that is one of the greatest joys of being a servant and a steward to the Lord. And so, the first thing we talked about, we want to be owners and lords. And then the second thing is, but we are called to be servants and stewards. And now for this last section, what I want to do is I want to turn probably to the most fascinating characters in this passage. And that is the true owner and the son of the vineyard. Now, According to ancient Near Eastern historian Kenneth Bailey, he says that in that time period, when someone sends a messenger, it's like they're sending themselves. And so if someone dishonors your messenger, it's almost like they're dishonoring you. And so what Bailey says about this particular parable is, he says that what the owner should have done is he should have cleaned house after the first messenger got dishonored. He should have reacted right away, because if he didn't, the owner would suddenly look weak. The owner would look incompetent. The owner would look incapable. But instead, this owner does the unthinkable thing in the ancient Near East. He sends another messenger. In fact, he sends another and another and another. He sends more and more messengers to the vineyard so that he can appeal to the tenants. Now, anybody at that time would listen to this story at the temple, and their first thought would be, why? Why would the owners do this? I mean, these are laborers that he's appealing to. Laborers are a dime a dozen. Laborers are expendable. Laborers are just not worth all this trouble. Why would the owner be willing to lose his reputation, lose his social position, lose his business over these few laborers? But for some reason, for some odd, strange reason, the owner wants to keep the tenants. The owner wants to hold on to them. And so, yes, when we read this parable, there is judgment at the end of this parable. But the picture that we get in this parable is that we have a picture of a God who does everything possible to keep it at bay. He does everything possible to delay it. And you know, today, I still believe that God is still delaying, that God is still sending his messengers to speak truth to us. And God could use a friend to do this. God could use scripture to do this. God could use, you know, any number of moments to do this, to remind us that we are not our own, that we are not in control of our lives, that the greatest joy that we could ever find is through loving and serving the Lord, knowing that we belong to Jesus Christ. You know, the latest messenger that came to me in my life was my newborn child, Kyla Emery Wu, because as this child was developing and as this child was growing in Jesse's womb, in my wife's womb, there was definitely a part of us that wanted to be in control, right? There was a part of us that wanted to be in charge, but we quickly realized that we don't control squat, right? We don't control squat. We couldn't control when Jesse got pregnant. We couldn't control if the baby would keep. We couldn't control how the baby would develop. You know, we couldn't control any of those things. The things that we could actually control in that process were minuscule. And so we prayed. We prayed because God, we just trusted that God was in control. We were just trying to trust God with whatever happens to this child. And it's hard, I know, to trust God for things like this because there's so many things that can happen to a career. There's so many things that can happen to a newborn life. There's so many things that can happen to a family. But that's part of just trusting that Jesus as a cornerstone, trying to trust God, that God is in control. You know, a little while back, I was watching this TED Talk, and it's just a bunch of really smart lecturers who, a TED Talk is smart lecturers who give lectures over different things. And at this time, the lecturer, his name was Alexander Sarris. And he had spent a large part of his life studying embryology. So he had spent a large part of his life studying the development of a child in the womb. And in his TED Talk, in his lecture, he was just sharing how amazing this process was. And one thing that he kept on saying that just kept on, like, I just kept on making a note of was he just kept on saying, it's hard to not attribute divinity to this. I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. And so what he's saying is, you know, as he's looking at the growing life in the womb, as he's looking at everything that's going on in there, all those millions of connections and all those, like, millions of developments, he's saying it's hard to look at this process and imagine that there isn't a God behind it all. And what fascinates me is that we all came from a mother's womb. We all came from a place where we were helpless, where we just had to let God weave and knit and craft and just shape us in there. But it's like almost the minute that we're born, we think that we can weave better. We think that we can knit and craft better. It's like we come out and suddenly we want to be owners and lords almost right away. We want to be in control. I think it's kind of crazy. And that's why I think I'm still glad that God continues to send messengers to remind us that we are not in control. But the amazing thing is, in this passage, the owner in the parable does not just send messengers, right? He doesn't. That would be extravagant enough. But the parable also tells us that the owner sends his beloved son. Now that is incredible. Because culturally, if the tenants wanted forgiveness after everything that they did, they should have been the ones to go to the owner. They should have taken the trip to the owner to beg. They should have taken the trip to the owner and said, hey, I'm going to do whatever. I made a mistake. Tell me what to do. Like, I will do whatever it is that I need to do to make things right. And you know, every other major religion is like this. If you want to get things right with God, if you want to get things right with the divine, you have to go up to him. You have to reach up to him. You have to do things to make things right with him. But here, in this passage, we are reminded that God sends his son. That is completely unexpected. You know, Christianity is the only faith where God doesn't say, reach up, but he steps down. You know, that's Jesus. And so I just want to challenge you here today. If you're here in the congregation today or you're here in the room today and you're just not sure about this Jesus thing, you're not sure about this Christianity thing, I just want to say, please, do not refuse him before you study him. Do not reject him before you take a look at his words and see if they have the ring of truth to them. Do not ignore him before you ask him to speak into your life somehow. Because if Jesus isn't who he says he is of absolutely no importance. No importance at all. But if Jesus is who he says he is, if Jesus is God in the flesh, he is of infinite importance. He is the cornerstone. And he doesn't just come to deliver a message. No, Jesus comes to deliver himself. That's what we celebrate this every Easter. That's what we celebrate, that Jesus comes to deliver himself. Because look, we have all wanted to be owners and lords of the vineyard. And that act of rebellion alone should have led to some kind of righteous judgment. Because eventually, God has to make things right. God is honor-bound to right the vineyard. God is honor-bound to fix things. But it's almost like on the cross, Jesus turns to the Father and he says to him, let me fix this. Let me receive the punishment for their rebellion. Let my death stand in the place for theirs. On the cross, Jesus takes a place for anyone who would receive him. He lives the life that we should have lived. He lives a life as a true servant and shepherd, steward. And on the cross, he receives the death that we deserve. He dies as an owner and a lord. So you see, Jesus doesn't just come to deliver a message, no. Jesus comes to deliver himself for you, to rescue you, even while you were his enemy. Like it says in Romans 5, that God demonstrates his own love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, while we still denied God, while we still refused him as owner and Lord, Christ died for us. That while we were still God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his son. And you know, that's how Jesus comes to you today. Not in the sword, but full of love, weak and vulnerable, ready to die for you. So please don't refuse him. Please don't deny him. Before you consider him, at least. Because if you reject him, you might be rejecting your cornerstone. You might be rejecting the one thing that will allow you to stand in this life and the next. You might be rejecting the source of where true joy comes from loving and serving the Lord. Amen.